cost shift, that it will be reviewed and not become institutionalized. The question of cost shifting brings up the larger question of access to health care. Access to health care and access to adequate health insurance are not coterminous definitions, although over the last few years they have come to be seen as being coterminous. What this bill intends to do is to modify the NAIC model in ways that we think are appropriate for Alaska. And again, specifically dealing with cost shifting and that individual modification, unlike virtually every other state, the size of the insured pool in Alaska is small, specifically the size of the pool that buys its insurance in Alaska. Of the approximately 550,000 people in the state, only approximately 250,000 buy their insurance in Alaska and would be therefore required to assume the burden of any cost shift. That makes what might be a 5% or a 2% or whatever small percentage of cost shift in a larger state magnified simply because of the small numbers of people who actually buy private health insurance in Alaska. So therefore, we feel that the changes that have been made by Senator Collins and the legislative drafter to the NAIC bill are indeed appropriate to the experience in Alaska. And with the addition of some type of sunset or mandatory legislative review, the administration is in support of Senate Bill 232. Are there any questions? I'd be glad to answer them if I can, or we'll put them in Mr. Brown.
Mr. Walsh, we had a bill on the only thing to comment is probably insurance on the bill, on a bill on the floor of the Senate this morning. And one of the issues there was cost shifting. We did get a fiscal note associated with the Division of Retirement Benefits for potential increases to the PERS system. It came in at a fairly late date. This, we heard some testimony today saying that it sounded like that most of the increase in the premiums would be borne by small businesses or the same group of people, but that seemed less assured that it's possible in the case of, say, Aetna, that there might be overflow into other kinds of covered people. In your review of this bill, did you check with the Department of Administration Retirement Benefits as far as potential cost shifting onto Aetna-covered state employees through something like this, and what the fiscal impacts would be to the state of should you get some cost shifting?
Mr. Chairman, I did not speak with Retirement Benefits directly. I did, however, speak with Commissioner Nucera. And in the development of the position paper on 242 and also the amendments that that went in at the HES committee, we feel that issue has been addressed because we feel that the statute would in fact prohibit cost shifting, as I read from page 4, lines 9 and 10. And so consequently, it's my understanding that the Department of Administration did not feel it necessary to analyze the impact because they felt there would be none. I cannot speak for them directly, but that's just my understanding.
Senator Duncan.
Well, Mr. Chairman, are we still on this?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, let's define cost shifting as you understand it, as so we know we're both talking about the same thing. We can do cost shifting means you're transferring costs to someone else that's perhaps already in the system.
In the system, but not in that particular pool, or in the case of 242 in this pool.
I want to get that clear. So you're saying that if you're not a small employer, you're identifying cost shifting that is moving it from the small employer market to the public employer market.
Yes, Senator, from the small employer market anywhere.
Okay. What about just moving it? Let's say we got small employers in this state of 25 employees or less. Let's say there's 1,000 of them. And right now, 500 of them are getting coverage, and they're paying $200 a month, which is, you can find one paying $200 a month. He shouldn't say much because he's got a good deal. But let's say we've got 500 and we're paying $200 a month. We enact this legislation and we bring in another 200. But the impact of that is to increase the premium for all small employers by 10%. Even those who are already covered, who weren't benefiting under this legislation, they were already being serviced. They weren't being redlined. They had a policy. And the impact of putting this in that mandates that certain people be served increases the premiums for all those individuals by 10 or 20%. That's not cost shifting?
Well, It is, Senator, and I don't think it would be something that the administration would be in favor of. The specific language that we recommended was does not shift program costs to other insured persons or the state. And I think ideally the plan of operation would be such that this group, the group served by this pool, would be a self-sufficient group. And I am not certain that, I mean, under the scenario you outlined, Senator, the administration would not be in favor of a cost shift to other small employers. Cost shifting, or I guess more the more accurate term would be cost sharing among those in this pool would be the purpose of the pool, but to shift those costs to those not in this pool would be something the administration would find very problematic.
Okay, and so let me ask you this question. I guess I don't know how the heck you do that. And I guess I'd prefer if Mr. Walsh, who's the expert in the insurance industry, tell me how, as director, you're going to put together a plan where you are mandated to cover people that you haven't covered in the past without, of course, one, making it very expensive to those folks, and maybe they can't even cover the full, and the other sections I'll talk to you about, they talk about the losses that might be incurred, et cetera, right? Without doing cost shifting. And secondly, how you prohibit that, other than just saying you can't do it, but third, how do you identify it? How do you know that, let's say right now premiums have been going up, let's just say 20% a year for small employers who are presently covered. And let's say next year Aetna says the trend line is going to be 25%, and Blue Cross says the trend line is going to be 25%. How do you know how much of that 25% is just would have been there if this bill wouldn't have been in place? And how do you know how much of that 25% is there because we put this in place? So how do you really know if there's cost shifting or not? You understand what I'm saying? I mean, you know, those guys, they put together the numbers and the rationale and the figures they're going to charge companies, and how are you going to tell whether it's just because it costs more to do business or because they're incurring losses somewhere else that they want to cover and they're hiding it from you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, those are all good questions. And let me start from the back and move forward and see. I hope I hit them all. With regard to how we can tell if cost shifting is taking place, we can do that from their filings and also from their annual financial statement. By way of comparison, we can tell when auto rates are put together, whether those rates are put together based upon the experience of an individual group or a plan or a pool, et cetera, or whether those rates are being put together based upon some type of community rating or other spreading of the costs. So that from a financial examiner's point of view, is not a challenge. The second question, and the main one, is how do you do a pool like this without doing some type of cost shifting somewhere? And that is a challenge. There is no question about it. In the for a system like this to work, some part of it has to be flexible. There has to be some change somewhere from what is currently on the street. Otherwise, what was on the street would cover everyone. By prohibiting cost shifting, or as other states have chosen to do, by prohibiting the injection of public funds for some type of direct subsidy. The plans like this can work based only upon two principles. Number one, that there is some benefit, some economy of scale by pooling, by getting a number of small employers together. And that benefit of economy of scale is significant enough to affect the rates. The second...
May I ask you a question? You mentioned the pooling. I mean, how are these people being brought together into a pool, and what are you talking about there?
It's basically a voluntary pool, as I understand it, that's put together to provide reinsurance and to pool together those small employers who are not now insured.
They all may be having different carriers.
Possibly.
They may all have different carriers, so it really isn't reducing administrative costs for any one carrier.
Well, no, not to the extent it would be if it were a single payer, that's true. But one of the premises of the model and one of the premises of this bill is that there is some economy of scale. How much is debatable and depends upon the number of carriers in the market. In this market, there aren't a large number of carriers. And so any benefit that would be there would perhaps be more recognizable simply because we don't have 20 or 30 carriers at any one time. The second area of flexibility is going to have to be on the extent of coverage. One of the things that the Health Benefit Plan Committee would do, would recommend benefit levels and cost-sharing levels, exclusions, limitations for basic standard plans, et cetera, and also recommend other cost containment features. It is in that area where the greatest potential lies for making this program self-sufficient. And the, I, when the administration considered the viability of these programs, given their overall philosophical approach, I think it's fair to characterize the conclusion in the following manner. With a heavy amount of subsidization, either directly from the state treasury or from cost shifting, plans like this have a significant chance of providing some benefit. Without those, it is a challenge to make plans like this work, and it's debatable whether or not they will. But we will never know if we don't take the opportunity to try to find out. And there appears to be a significant benefit to the currently uninsured population if this plan works. And the overall concerns of the administration, with the exception of the sunset provision, have been met, and therefore the administration is in support of 242.
Just to follow up with a couple more things, and I want to ask specific questions about how this works. So what you're saying is that you'll prevent cost shifting. You, the director, I guess, has to approve any plan. So you'll prevent cost shifting by ensuring that the actual rate increases that the small insurer, that the carriers are asking for other small insurers reflect not the fact that they're having losses with this group, but the actual cost of doing business for the other group. And also you'll look at those rate filings and all those financial statements and everything else to ensure that even the public employers aren't getting some cost shift. You know, the deep pockets not getting hurt by this, right?
Yes, sir. That is our intent.
And do you do that kind of in-depth analysis right now? Filings and financial statements?
Yes, sir. We have we have to do that on numerous other lines, particularly for companies that write multiple lines.
Will this increase your workload?
It will. We believe we can at least for the foreseeable future absorb this within our work program. At least that has been the decision that's been made.
Well, maybe I've been supporting your budget incorrectly. Then I thought you folks were overworked already. So we've probably been overstaffing you folks for several years. Then, if you think you've got enough time because of all this increased work, and I don't think it's going to be an easy task, Mr. Walsh. I think it's going to be a very difficult task. And you've got folks sitting over there who are just chomping at the bit to have something to do, to evaluate all these filings and financial statements and go out and do the audits that are probably necessary and to really ensure there's no question.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I have a very hardworking group of people who, like Mr. Garlington, are around most weekends. And we do not feel that the burden of this program is going to be insignificant. However, this is just one program of a number that we already do. And we don't feel that, at least at this point, the incremental addition of this program is going to require additional resources. That is not to say that we have people sitting around with nothing to do. And certainly Mr. Garlington and the other people who are across the street today would be glad to come over and test again.
Yeah, and I've never said that they are, but the point is they are busy 100% of the time and on weekends. Then Mr. Garlington probably would like to go home sometime and take off his shoes and kick back and have a beer just like everybody else, right? So the point is you're not going to do this and do it right with the same staffing. And I think your fiscal note is erroneous, and that's my point. And I think that it's erroneous because the administration's overall philosophical approach is to do anything they can to help the insurance industry and the provider community, but not really help or protect the consumer, and it's the small business people who are going to suffer under this. This bill does just as other bills. Very little for consumers. It does much for those who are, does much for the insurance industry, I guess, and perhaps even the provider community, but does very little for the consumer. But just give me an honest, and you know, this company line, if it's got to be company line, but can you seriously, without any question in your mind, tell me that you can determine that a plan is suitable to assure the fair, reasonable, and equitable administration program on a proportional basis in the provision of this section does not shift program costs to other insurers to state. Will you ever be able to do that?
Yes.
I mean, it will, and what kind of a plan will you have if you do that?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Duncan, yes, I think we can, because that's basically our job now, to make certain that every line of insurance that comes in, and there are dozens of them, and when you talk about the permutations in the different groups that are under any given plan, you're talking about more than, you're talking about multiple dozens of them. So yes, I think that we can do that.
And what kind of plan will you have for the small business people?
It's going to be a plan that's going to have to be very tightly drawn. The Health Benefit Plan Committee is going to have a very, very serious burden in determining within resources available for members of this plan what benefits are going to be there, what cost-sharing levels, et cetera. Whether this program works is going to be determined basically by the Health Plan Committee.
It's fair to say that probably the benefits will be very minimal and the cost-sharing will be between employer and employee will be pretty substantial, and maybe even deductible?
I don't know. I think that it's fair to say that the policy that's provided under this mechanism will be different than the standard policy in more than just price. And if that sounds like it's too general, I apologize. I don't know how much farther you can go, because it would really get speculative. The Health Plan Committee may say we want to provide the same level of benefits, but in exchange for that, we're going to have a very, very high deductible. Or they may say that the important thing is to keep the deductible low and make this a threshold policy that would not provide necessarily, the same type of coverage that's available on the street now, but would keep the deductible the same to get more people into it. And that's really not a call that the division could make now, or for that matter, could really make then. I mean, that's what the Health Plan Committee would be all about.
Do you know the insurance commissioner in Georgia?
Tim Riles, very well.
Yes. Why is he saying what he's saying in the Wall Street Journal? He's looked at this legislation and says it's basically what he's opposing in Georgia. Why is he saying that the impact, I mean, they came out real strong against it and saying the impact is going to be to increase costs substantially to small business persons and drive more people out of the market?
I've talked with Commissioner Riles about this and explained to him what our position was on cost shift. And he is very concerned about the cost shift. That's what appears to be the driving argument in his opposition to the NAIC model. The NAIC models are just that. I mean, they don't purport to be applicable in every situation, and there's probably not a one of them that you would find all 55 insurance directors and commissioners in favor of. He and I have the same problem with the NAIC model that has been introduced in Georgia and that was initially under consideration here, and that is the cost-shifting aspect to it. The additions that were made in the substitute currently before this committee take away that is a major issue. The addition of some type of sunset makes certain that there will be some review and that won't be an issue in the future. Commissioner Riles has asked me to send him a copy of whatever we come up with, and I will do that because he told me personally that if the issue of cost shifting could be resolved, it would go a long way towards taking care of his objections to the NAIC model.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
I'm going to have to go, but I wonder if the committee could look at page 21, item 25, the definition of a small employer. We've had testimony on the teleconference, and Senator Duncan has alluded to the fact that the definition of a small employer is 25 or less, but that's not what this legislation says. And if that's what we are talking about, maybe we could consider saying that it will be 25 employees or less. And then on page 19, section 12, an eligible employee, it seems as though we're targeting a certain group. Under this eligible employee to get up to three, if you don't change that other section, it says that an eligible employee has to be full-time with a normal work week of 30 hours and includes a sole proprietor or partner or a contract independent contractor. And then it says provided, and then it goes on and says some other things. So I think that the people that are, if you have two people and the individual that owns the business does not work for the company, he may not be eligible. So if we're really trying to target a small employers, maybe we should consider including all people under 25, and I just make that comment. And hopefully I'll be back. I have to go testify on my bill down in judiciary.
Did anyone want to respond to Senator Hoffman's concerns?
Mr. Garlington, I think, would give a much more cogent response than I.
Just for the record, I'm Stan Garlington, insurance market analyst. I guess if I might go back to a comment that Senator Duncan had made a little bit earlier about the type of work that the Division of Insurance staff would like to be doing on our Saturdays and weekends and holidays and the other work days that Director Walsh has outlined for us. I think I can speak for all of us that we'd much prefer spending time reviewing plans that provide insurance and solve problems than to spend the same amount of time attending hearings, participating in task forces, and answering the innumerable questions that come in to all of us at the division from Alaskans who are unable to get health insurance, who have problems with health insurance.
Mr. Chairman, that's an interesting comment. I hope Mr. Walsh has got a different attitude than this administration does, too. And I wasn't taking a shot at you as employees of the division. I think you do work hard. But quite honestly, I am really frustrated with the attitude of the administration. If that reflects Mr. Walsh's attitude, I'm surprised that public employees should not respond to constituent inquiries or to legislative inquiries or to participate in public hearings or to participate in task force. I haven't seen you at a task force meeting. So, Mr. Walsh, maybe you better clarify that. You find this a waste of time? If so, then get up and leave.
Now, Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, I certainly don't think so, and I believe that what Mr. Garlington was trying to say is it's much more professionally satisfying to be able to work with people to obtain coverage than it is to deal with them when they're not able to find it. And I, under no conditions do I feel that participation in task force and legislative hearings, et cetera, is something that is beyond the scope of what we're supposed to do. And I think that the record of the division over the last couple of years would bear that out. And for any offense that the division has given here in this matter, I apologize. I have found the task force in particular to be a very valuable exercise and look forward to continuing that and coming up with some concrete solutions to the problem.
Maybe we could get a more specific answer to Senator Coughlin's question on the 25 employees. And
the purpose of the definition of small employer was to ensure that there was no shift from the individual insurance market to the group market. And with three individuals, one's truly dealing with a group rather than with individuals. So it was felt important to avoid any type of cost shifting through abuse of the group category of health coverage. In regard to the other question regarding sole proprietors and partnerships, sole proprietors and partnerships and corporations and so forth function as a description of the ownership of the employer and not necessarily the number of individuals who are involved in the business operation. So regardless of the form of ownership of business, if there are three employees, basically full-time employees, they would become eligible for this program, and it would remain a truly group program.
Further questions of Mr. Walsh for the division?
Yes.
Senator.
Mr. Walsh, maybe we could just go to page 10. Could you just explain that section 2155.120 in good, clear layman terms, the premium rate restriction? Premium rate for health benefit plans in chapter 7.
Senator, could you speak up a little bit?
Sure. Could you go to page 10, 2155.120 and explain premium rate restrictions, how that premium rate for health benefit plan is set subject to the following provisions, and just kind of follow that through for me so I can understand how that premium rate is
Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, I think most simply put, the premium is capped at 135% of an index rate. The index rate is basically what the insurer would voluntarily charge the same or similar coverage to similar employers in their voluntary program.
Okay, so the premium is capped at 135%. This morning on the forum at the high risk pool, we had a cap of 200% premium. We did a forum in there. But this premium is capped at 135%. Is that correct? A normal premium? So these employers, small employers, could expect to pay at a maximum of 135% more?
35%.
Yes. 35% more, excuse me. 135%. 35% more?
Correct.
Correct. Okay, then tell me how that relates to Section 7 on page 23.
What I believe Section 7 does is it tries to control the increased cost maximum for the employers in this pool in terms of rate increases that would apply to the rates that the insurer voluntarily charges.
Okay,
then it attempts to address the spiral effect.
You've read it differently than I have, and so I want to be sure I understood it, because I read if your definition, and I accept that, on page 10 is to say 135% of premium. That sets the maximum. As I read section 7, regarding a health benefit plan subject to AS 21-155 or 21-155-110, and that is delivered or issued for delivery before July 1st, 1992, a premium rate for a rating period may exceed the ranges set out in AS 21-155-120. So it looks like to me, up from July 1st, 1992 through June 30th, 1995, we really don't have any cap.
Mr. Chair, this looks like it says in section of analysis that this is a transitional section as it relates to a premium rate.
Right, so there's no cap in the first 3 years.
Essentially, that's correct. As the program goes in and the baseline is established, that at some point there has to be a snapshot taken on which the 135 is based. What this does is it sets that snapshot over a period of time as this program goes in. There are, of course, other ways to do it. There are other bills where it would be set as of a pre-existing date, etc. But I believe that the reason this was put in the fashion that it is that the small employer health plan segment of the market is not particularly developed. It's not one of those that, like, for example, the life market, where you would say that we're pretty much at if not terminal development of the product lines, at least in a static position with a basically developed marketplace, so you could take a snapshot based upon 1/1/92. In this instance, it's what this is designed to do is to encourage some flexibility in the marketplace as these are put together, so that as that snapshot gets taken, it's taken with a market much more developed than this market is now.
So, I guess, and I'm really trying to understand it, because I want to be able to explain it to myself at least. So, what we're saying is that for that first period of time, there really is no base normal premium, or so there's really no cap of 135%. But after that period, then there will be a cap of 135%. But meanwhile, during those 3 years, it's quite probable and possible that the insurance premiums will increase dramatically, so that when it finally is capped at 135%, it's capped at 135% of a real high base.
Well, I think that theoretically that's possible. What will hopefully prevent that from happening is the division of insurance, number one, and number two, the marketplace itself. And number three, as the health benefit plan committee kicks into effect, there'll hopefully be some curbs on that. Unfettered And totally unregulated, sure. I think that's what would happen, but I don't think that would happen.
Well, the marketplace itself hasn't been doing very good, hasn't been a very good regulator recently when it's been 30% a year for small company insurance premiums. And it seems to me that the natural tendency would be for the insurance industry to get that base as high as possible before 1995. And I think it compounds your folks' job of ensuring that there's not some unnecessary inflationary factors in there so that the insurance industry has a high base to work from July of 1995. I think it's a real loophole. I think it's a problem. I think we should set the base as of January 1st, 1991 or 1992. We should do it retroactively so we know there's no inflation built into these premiums by the insurance industry. Then we'll get a real handle on it.
If I may respond, Mr. Chairman, from the division's perspective, that we would consider that to be a policy call by the legislature. You know, we are not wedded to any particular methodology, but we'll do our best to regulate whatever methodology the legislature chooses to adopt.
You would consider that then a friendly amendment to this bill on solving the problem of cost shifting if we tie a base that's already there instead of a forward base where they can inflate unreasonably and the base is much higher than it should be?
It would not be, from our point of view, it would be neither friendly nor unfriendly. I mean, it would be a decision for the legislature to make. There's an upside and a downside. The upside is, of course, is that there is certainty going in. The downside is that the flexibility that we hope will develop in the marketplace could be severely retarded. But that's basically a policy call for the legislature to make and not for ours. We feel comfortable with this language the way it is.
Well, and there is downside and upside. And of course, there's downside and upside on flexibility. And so far, the flexibility insurance market has all been on the upside. Not on the downside. I haven't seen any of that downside flexibility yet in the insurance industry. Is that good policy, you think? Give me your judgment. Company line, I know you've got a new company line. Good policy to set a base not set a base 3 years prospectively, but to say, look, we're not going to allow a lot of inflationary spiral built in here before the base is set.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, we think that this is an acceptable way of doing things, given this committee that's going to be developed and with the sunset clause. I mean, so that there is some mandatory review, so that if the worst case scenario does in fact happen, the legislature and the governor have a chance to look at this program and either modify it or do away with it before it does any significant damage. Unfortunately, all of these things are breaking new ground. And if there were a roadmap that's been developed, or if this had been a tried and true method in other states, then it might be easy to say you should take one option or the other. But the model opts for, and what we feel very comfortable with, is this more flexible approach to rate setting during the transition period. And it's debatable whether it's the best approach, and only a review after a period of time is going to determine it.
Fine. And you know, I appreciate that answer, and I think it should be clear that the model, of course, that we're basing this all on is an insurance industry model.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, no, sir. It's the National Association of Insurance Commissioners model that was developed, probably if it went the path of the usual models, over probably a 2 to 4 year period. During that time, there is no question that the insurance industry had input and had the opportunity to testify. But also during that period of time, so did consumer groups, and the final arbiter were the 54 other folks like me, and we consider ourselves to be representatives of the consumers and not of the insurance industry.
What's your former line of work? I'm sorry. Mr. Walsh, could you prepare me an amendment, though, to do what I want to do as far as setting the base, say, January 1st, 1992?
Yes, sir.
Okay. One last question, then. Page, and I don't intend to hold the bill for that amendment. I'll offer it on the floor if I get the minute.
Well, Page, can I just add, I mean, if you didn't have your transition language, you would have the language of 21-20 operative, right? Mm-hmm.
Is that basically all we need to do?
I think so. Stan and I think so, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Donaldson and I will have to take a look at that, but we can have you an answer, you know, in a half hour or so.
Okay.
On that same notion, though, if you're advocating a 3-year sunset, how does that fit into anything after 3 years?
Well, if it would allow us to have some type of mandatory review as the transition period started to close. I mean, if we saw that what Senator Duncan
the scenario that Senator Duncan laid out was in fact coming true, then we may be able, then we may want to redesign the program, pick a date, you know, prior to the start of the spiral or whatever. Our concern is that if we go through this transition period, then you allow a couple more years or, quote, things to work, unquote, before you take a look at it at all, it could be very well be an entrenched program that would be very, very difficult to alter and virtually impossible to eliminate.
Well, I guess all I'm saying is technically that if you did three-year sunset and you had this transition language, you might as well delete all of the Section 2155.120. I mean, that's only good after the three-year period anyway. And presumably, if you didn't like what was happening, you'd go back and adjust your 35% increase per year after that time, right?
I guess our thought was, Mr. Chairman, that you'd want all that language in there, even if there was the sunset, so you would know the framework that you were within which you were trying to build. And we would have no objection to even a five-year sunset, as long as there was something that was put in there that would require some type of mandatory review. You could conceivably say, we're going to develop this, then we're going to come back and we're going to write the program after 3 years. The problem with that, of course, is that then it's really blue sky. And this committee could go in a number of different directions. We feel that it's much more appropriate for the policymakers to say, here is where we want you to go and roughly how we want you to get there, with the kind of language that's in here, and then give them a transition period, as opposed to say we're going to do this transition period and then maybe create something which may or may not look like the NAIC model in 3 years.
Senator Duncan, I apologize. I think you still had a question.
No, I appreciate your question. I want to go back to page 6, Mr. Chairman, if I could, now that we've done it. You hold another. And I just want to add a couple of things on page 6, Mr. Walsh, if I could. First of all, on page 6, on line 4, subsection 1 there, what's that say?
Through the chair, section 1 addresses a formula for an insurer's assessment share. Because the reinsurance association, although nonprofit, would have no capital and surplus, a mechanism was needed in case there were cash flow anomalies or if there are unanticipated problems, so that the entity would not end up insolvent and bankrupt through that type of a process. So the assessment provisions were retained in the bill as a solvency and as a fiscal issue, and this retains the formula from the NAIC model.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, what this says essentially to the companies is they better work hard to make this work, because if it doesn't work, they're going to pay at the end of the sunset period and not the state. So that there is not a situation where they come in here at the end of a 3 or 5 year sunset provision and the committee comes in and says, well, we tried, but we've got a $15 million deficit and the state's got to fund it. What this says is that everyone involved better pay very, very close attention from day one, because this is not the deep pocket that's going to bail anybody out in the case of failure.
So the state will not pay that $15 million. The insurance company will just swallow that loss.
Absolutely.
And they will not then try to recoup that loss by increasing premiums to all other people they are insuring, including state employees.
Yes, Senator, that's the way it's set up.
How are you going to ensure they don't do that?
We can do that when they file their annual statements, when we review their rate reform filings. We can see to it if this happens and if there is a big assessment, it's going to pop up on their annual statement. And
they may not pick up the whole thing at once. They may say, well, let's just be careful. Walsh is pretty sharp here, and he'll see a $15 million assessment or an increase in premiums to reflect this $15 million loss, and we'll spread it over 10 years.
One of the things that already shows up on their financial statements are the guarantee association assessments, which are also not tax deductible in this state. And it's basically a separate line, and that's what we would do for this as well.
And you can say unequivocally there's no way that loss can be shifted to anyone else in this state?
I don't believe that there is, Senator. I mean, I think that's what the language says, that's what the division is committed to, you know. I can't absolutely certify that somebody isn't going to make a run at it. I can certify that the language prohibits it, and we'll do everything we can to make certain that it doesn't happen.
What's the say? What's that subparagraph 6 say then? On page 6.
While we're looking for that, if I could make an announcement here, we're going to have to quit around 4. We're not going to get to House Bill 572 on fees or the semi-related Senate Bill 474. I know there's a lot of people from agencies that we had asked to testify. It involves a lot of different departments and fees, and I apologize. We're not going to get to it. If some of the agency people had specific amendments or changes or alterations in their fees, please get any amendments or questions to my staff. And we're trying to make some orderly sense out of all the fees and how they relate to either the House or the Senate budgets. And we'll bring that back up first order of business on when we meet on Monday. And we obviously a lot of that stuff is critical to completing our operating budget work. And so we are going to give that bill or those bills high priority. Again, my apologies. I think it's all we're going to be able to do is just to complete the remainder of yesterday's schedule here. Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, the paragraph 6 on page 6, line 25, is essentially an early warning system or a safety valve to make certain that if there are losses, if they exceed 5% and there has to be this kind of assessment, that the board takes a serious look at what they think is going to happen, and they make a report which can then be analyzed by us, by the companies, and I would hope also by the legislature and the rest of the administration. No organization ever goes bankrupt or goes broke overnight. It's the result of a continual downsliding trend. And what we wanted to avoid with this, what the model wants to avoid, is a situation where an assessment can be made in a losing year, that becomes a pattern of doing business, and all of a sudden the whole house of cards collapses. This is to make certain that if there is a losing year, that there be some written justification for it and some scrutiny by not only the companies who are involved, but the regulators as well, to make certain that the trend can either be reversed, the program can be ended, or whatever measures need to be taken are taken to reverse the negative experience.
Well, and I just had one more question, and I apologize. This is not an easy bill.
No. It's not an easy bill.
Page 5, then, and I just want to be sure I understand this. Page 5, line 12. Page 5, line 12, we're talking about premium rates charged for coverage reinsured by the association shall be established as required under E of this section. And E of this section is, let's see, what's E of this section here?
Page 5.
Anyway.
I'm sorry, it's under page 5?
Yeah. Page 5. Line 12, talking again about premium rates for coverage reinsured by the association. And they're going to be established, one, for whole group small employer reinsurance coverage, 1.5 multiplied by the base premium rate established by the association for eligible employees. Now, how does that coincide with the 1.35 that we're talking about?
Through the chair, the 135% addresses the maximum premium charge that would go to a small employer.
Okay.
The calculation of the premium that would be paid by the insurer pulls in up to the 135% from the small employer for the coverage that's provided through the pool. The pool will receive premium calculated on this basis, which is what funds the reinsurance pool. The monies that are received by the reinsurance pool then get translated into the amount of claims that the reinsurance pool can cover. And through the health benefit plan committee, this translates into the parameters under which they develop the coverage programs, the deductibles, what's going to be covered, the cost containment measures, and so forth.
Okay, so let's just run through it so I understand it. I don't understand this stuff. So, if I'm a small employer and the normal premium is $100, I'm going to pay $135. Maximum.
Well, if you could purchase coverage for $100 and you have coverage, you would not be falling into this program.
No, but the normal premium in the small group market is $100. Mm-hmm. Under the formula in this bill, the cap, the maximum that I can pay is 135%. So I can pay $135.
Correct.
So I, as an employer, pay $135, but the actual cost, premium cost, that the insurance company has to cover can be 1.5 of $100. It could be $150. So the insurance company is taking a $15 loss?
No, this sets the maximum for their reinsurance. For the reinsurance that they buy, so that the reinsurer can't unnecessarily hike the rates because it's a pool. I blush to admit, but I readily admit that how reinsurers set their rates for pools is something that I do not have a complete grasp of. I think it's certainly not cutting open a gullet looking at the entrails, but it's about that foreign to me. What the technicians tell me is that this language is necessary to make certain that it sets the parameters that the pool will pay for reinsurance. And it is, although it relates to the 135% that any individual employer would pay, it is separate and distinct from that because it has to do with the calculation based upon the total premiums that the reinsurance authority, or that the pooling authority would have.
So the pooling authority that's getting the insurance for these people who are in the reinsurance pool, most the employer can pay is 135%, but the pooling authority might have to purchase insurance at 150%.
But the basis is a different 100%. The basis for the 135% is the amount of the average premium on the street.
Right.
The basis for the 150% is the amount of loss that is being insured. And that's different than the rate, because within the rate is administrative expense, claims, etc. But there is a portion of every premium that the reinsurers calculate as the actual risk that's out there, as opposed to the administration of that risk. And it's that 100% that this goes through.
But is it fair to say that this 150% will be much greater than 135%?
No.
Fair to say it'll be much less?
Ideally, it'd be about the same, but it could not be. I mean, you point out if it's much greater, you point out the obvious inconsistency.
Yeah.
Because you can't lose money on every transaction and make it up in volume. So it may be less, it may be the same, but it is not going to be substantially more.
And number two, even compound your problem, you say for eligible employer dependent reinsurance coverage, 5.0 multiplied by the basic premium rate established by the association. I'm trying to see how you folks are saying that anybody, that there's not going to be tremendous losses with this reinsurance association, one. If there isn't tremendous losses, then there has to be tremendous caution.
Well, the distinction between the 1.5 for a group and the 5 for an individual is that the small group employer has the option to elect to reinsure either an individual within the group or the entire group, and this addresses potential adverse selection in that area and balances out. But overall, the reinsurance association will only have a certain pool of money, and that's what the coverage they're going to be able to provide is going to be based upon. has to be tied to the 135%. And the actuaries and folks who are far more scrupulous with numbers than I are the ones who do the number crunching to get these things in the balance in this area as they do in other areas.
So it comes back to the point that to avoid losses, then, if they can, if the reinsurance, people who do the reinsurance can charge 1.5, or the rate of their premium would be 1.5 or 5 times, in order for this association to avoid losses, what they need to do then is really cut benefits dramatically, or increase co-payment, or increase deductibles, or something, and you probably end up with a pretty shabby plan.
Mr. Senator Duncan, it's again, it's a different basis on the number that you multiply by, either 135% or, in this case, 5.0. 100 cents of every premium dollar does not go for risk.
No, I know about 40% of it goes for administrative overhead to insurance companies now, and, or more. I mean, that's why health care is so high.
And what the actuarial types say is that this is, given the 135% for the on-the-street rate calculation, that both the 1.5 and the 5.0 are reasonable figures to make certain that the reinsurance premium that's paid by the association is reasonable. And as I said before, even with this calculation, and I do not profess to understand it in its intricacies or even in its simplicity, the plan would be sound. Obviously, it can't be much more, or they very quickly go into the red. I can bring our actuary, Barbara Thurston, in if the committee would like, but we can bring them by phone if necessary. But those two calculations are based upon an actuarial assessment of reinsurance and bear little direct relation to the actual premium dollar that's on the street, or the 135% of premium dollar that the members of this pool will pay.
Mr. Chairman, on the issue of reinsurance, I have a question with respect to reinsurance. The whole idea of a reinsurance mechanism isn't new. I mean, I know that, for example, within the workers' comp setting, that most typically insurance companies that carry workers' compensation insurance reinsure their premiums and their losses through a reinsurance mechanism, so usually for catastrophic injuries or illnesses that develop. So the whole mechanism of reinsurance isn't new.
Right. That is correct, Senator.
And then so it has a history of somehow it works. I don't understand it, but somehow it does work. Is that correct?
One can only hope. Mr. Chairman, my knowledge of reinsurance is growing daily, but what Senator Collins says is indeed correct. It's a mechanism that's been around for some time, and what this does is it sets the upper limits on what that reinsurance can cost.
For those people who have been online or in the audience for Senate Bill 343, Crime and Conspiracy, we're not going to get back to that bill either, so that will also be moved to Monday's calendar. My apologies.
Mr. Chairman, what's our schedule on this bill and for the rest of the afternoon? Or I think we have more people to testify and all sorts of things here.
Right. Yeah, we're going to go till about 4, then we have other things. We're going to get back at 4:30 on the operating budget. I think Senator Petula wants to look at some additional changes to the operating budget. We hope to get through the public testimony on 242. What I'd like is that if we could, if the department or the division could prepare the amendment, at least for our review on this transition language versus the 135% limits in the other portion. And also, if the division could, I know you've submitted this general intent or desire for a sunset provision, but you didn't provide the specifics on that. If you could provide the committee for, again, just at least for our discussion, the sunset, and you'd mentioned 5 years and 3 years, and if you could just put into the exact language what you had in mind. And also, then, Senator Hoffman, I shouldn't have had them respond to your question. I apologize. I think they answered some of your question, but maybe if you could have discussions or they could get back to you on the intent of this small employer definitions. I think they seem to have an adequate answer, but it may or may not satisfy you. Maybe you guys could communicate a little bit on that. So it would be my hope that we could finish up public testimony, prepare the elements that we need to do to complete deliberations and then conclude our action on the bill early on Monday. That would be my intent. In addition, we've got some people signed up for testimony on 366, also Senator Collins, and hopefully we could hear from Senator Collins and our people who have signed up to testify on 366 before we can do our business at 4. Was there any kind of lost track where we were at? Senator Duncan, did you?
No, but if you're going to, wait a minute, I think we could also ask for a fiscal note so we don't get blindfolded on the floor from the kind of benefits.
Yes. Actually, we can do that.
Yeah.
But I feel a little leery of that myself, and I think I want to just, rather than having some other department ask them, I think we'll ask the department, DOA directly ourselves.
Sure. I didn't need to point Mr. Yeah. Walsh, but he's found the whole knowledge here, so.
And it's a pretty arid land.
Further questions or further testimony by the division? No, thank you very much. We'd also had a request to hear from the NFIB. Risa Gerald, you had signed up to testify. Would you like to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Risa Gerald. I'm the state director for NFIB. When your staff called and asked me to put some thoughts together, I redid a bunch of things. There should have been some letters transmitted that I'd sent to Senator Collins before. I went back and reread a bunch of government accounting office reports and a bunch of national NFIB testimony to see if there was some more information I could give you folks other than what you already had. So some of this I'm going to have to read because I haven't been over to facilitate times. NFIB is comprised of 4,703 small companies and independent businesses. The legislative agenda of NFIB is determined by our annual ballot, which is a poll of our membership, and that sets our policy for legislative sessions. In 1991, I knew something was coming up on health insurance in the legislature, and so I visited with Senator Duncan's staff extensively to try to devise a question for my members that might fit what might be happening. It's a real tough thing in the fall to try to come up with questions that are going to fit what's going to happen 6 months later. But anyway, so the book I came up with, should legislation be passed in order to create a voluntary health insurance plan which would be administered by private insurance companies and which would pool small businesses together so they could purchase employee health insurance at group rates? And 72% of the people said yes. I asked them, if this pooling of employers in order to purchase health insurance was available, would you participate? And then 50% said they would. Should employers be allowed the option of having their employees pay part of the premium cost of health insurance purchased through the above pooling plan? 90% said yes, naturally. We have a foundation that does research and surveys of our members. And in 1986, for the first time, the number one concern of small business was health insurance. Again, in 1992, 92% of small business owners characterized health insurance as a serious problem. This year, they recently did a survey, and they have found that the number one priority, again, is health insurance, with no other difficulty even being close to it. 61% of the people rank the problem as very critical, which is the most extreme assessment that they can give on the options they have. Further surveys have found that small business owners want to offer health insurance as a fringe benefit out of a sense of family obligation and competitive necessity, quite frankly. The ability of small business owners to provide insurance is greatly influenced by the high cost of premiums and profitability of the business. For many small businesses, their skyrocketing annual premium increases, small profit margins, struggling regional economics, and restricted cash flow are all contribute to the increasing difficulty small business owners have purchasing health insurance. If the cost of purchasing or continuing to provide health insurance continues increasing, small business owners will be forced to increase employee contributions, cut benefits, or in some cases, drop coverage. Small businesses are more severely impacted by adverse selection and the demographics of their workforce. They have high employee turnover, resulting in unpredictability in the participation rates that the insurance carriers come up with, and a lack of expertise in purchasing insurance. By virtue of their size, small businesses have very little access to cost containment mechanisms available to large firms, such as self-insurance. Being unable to obtain the benefits of self-insurance, they must comply with extensive state mandates, pay state premium taxes, and shoulder a larger portion of the carrier's administrative expenses. While other folks were testifying, I would look at one of these GAO reports. If you have 1 to 4 people in your insurance group, the total percentage of your premium, 40% of it, is for administrative costs. If it's 5 to 9, 35%, and it goes on down as the larger your number gets in it. The breaking point is about 12%. 12% have 500 to 2,400 employees. So there's bound to be some way to gather some cost savings by getting all of our small businesses together with just looking at those numbers. That's a lot of money. Small business owners desire to build on the remaining existing health system we have at the present time. Senate Bill 242 is a voluntary health program that provides accessibility, renewability, predictability, and stability for small businesses. It is a viable means of providing health insurance for the uninsured population in Alaska. And I know you have heard probably testimony before that a large portion of the uninsured are work for small employers. State mandates cumulatively can raise the cost of health insurance for small businesses. Senate Bill 242 has provision that state mandates do not apply to the health benefit plans provided to small employers. This will allow the insurance industry to design and market health insurance policies without the mandates. This could lead to a lower cost plan, which would have a great appeal to firms that currently do not offer health insurance coverage. Small businesses are willing to provide health insurance to their employees as long as the cost is not prohibitive. It also requires the small employer insurers to disclose information relating to premium rates and health benefit plans. It requires insurers to describe in detail their weighting practices and renewal underwriting practices. Providing this information will help small business owners to be better informed. The Congressional Budget Office believes that, quote, giving consumers the information they need to make more informed decisions might enhance both the quality and cost effectiveness of care. We have a couple of suggestions. Senator Hoffman brought it up. We understand the problems of including sole proprietors, but there are a lot of sole proprietors that do not have health insurance, and there's mom-and-pop firms out there that don't have health insurance. The footwear gallery out in the Nugget Mall, that's run by a husband and wife, and she has had a medical problem in the past, and they pay astronomical amount of money for their insurance with an exclusion for what her problem was in the past. Another suggestion I have is the potential of possibly standardizing forms. When I was rooting around in my file, a lot of people were testifying right there. I run across a press release that our president put out. It says, consider this, for every dollar spent on health care in this country, nearly a quarter goes to pay for paperwork. The New England Journal of Medicine estimates that if this nation could reduce health care paperwork by half, we could save more than $100 billion per year. At the average of $20,000 per person for top-of-the-line insurance premium, this would buy a lot of health and coverage. Health insurance coverage for the uninsured. That's my idea. He goes on to talk about how to save the forest, too, in this article. It's really interesting. With other types of paper, right? I thank you for the opportunity to testify on this legislation and be invited in. If you have any questions, I certainly would be willing to try to answer them. I'm an actuarial expert. I'm just a general lobbyist.
Mr. Carroll, thank you very much. Senator?
Just one comment, and I appreciate your testimony, because I wanted it on record. And the thing that struck me most about your testimony was the statement that the ability of the small business owner to provide insurance is greatly influenced by the high cost of premiums and profitability of the businesses. And we have identified through the work that we've been doing on the task force that a large percentage of the uninsured Alaskans are small business people, and that does need to be addressed.
guess the question I'd have, Darrell, is based on your statement, and one of the reasons they're not insured now, maybe because they're being redlined. Secondly, is, as you said, high cost of premiums. So if they can't get into the market now because of high cost of premiums, how does this legislation solve the problem when the premium can be 135%?
There are some people that might be able to, like my friend out at the footwear gallery, she might be able to have full coverage instead of not cancer coverage.
She can't get cancer coverage.
She would have, under this plan, someone like that that cannot get coverage would be able to get coverage.
Okay, that's one example, but the normal small business person who doesn't have that problem and who's being redlined, maybe redlined, or maybe just can't afford it, just normal coverage, right?
So how does
135% of premium make them more accessible?
It's accessible for those who cannot get it. That's the accessibility is the main thing. I talked to, Lady Eva, she says there's all sorts of people here in town, small businesses, that would like to have health insurance, but they cannot. Just because of the people that are in their group, they have an elderly person with a heart problem or something, they can't buy another policy. So this would at least afford accessibility. Now, affordability, that is a whole function of the marketplace. Me, as a consumer of the market of insurance, purchasing insurance, I may choose myself personally to stay with the ridiculously cheap, quote-unquote, health insurance I have is catastrophic only, and they will not choose. I figured out a way how to group together so that we'd be eligible for this. I may not choose to get in. It's a person's own pocketbook when you're in business.
And the lady with cancer probably was helping her send those 74 this morning, the high-risk pool. So,
that's a possibility.
Sure. I guess the only point I wanted to make, again, is we're probably focusing on a very narrow portion, very small portion of the uninsured Alaskans in the population. And it's going to be, again, those on the more wealthy end of it. Because it's going to be 135% of premium we think. And we don't even know what the premium base is going to be. It may be, the premium base may be two or three times higher than it is right now by the time 3 years expires.
It may very well be. I think there are some cost savings via the mandates. Mandates are expensive. I forget the number we have in the state of Alaska, but you have those. I think that's 16 or 20. And they all cost money. They're going to have to pay for those mandates. It costs. I think there are potential cost savings. I think that there's potential cost savings with the administrative costs. That the possibility of your truth. It might not be a whole bunch, but it's better than nothing.
Further questions? Senator Paul?
I'd like to make a couple of comments, I think, to kind of summarize some of the questions that have been asked and kind of maybe do some general statements. I appreciate Senator Duncan's questions. He and I have come on this partnership from two different points of view. I think Senator Duncan has been studying the issue for some time, and I have been involved in healthcare for many years, and as a matter of fact, probably the last 17 years I've been involved in what is called medical management, which is a cost-containment measure. So I really appreciate his expertise, and really appreciate all the questions that he asked, because it helped me understand some of those things better. It's really a shame that we didn't devote this amount of time to this approach during the task force. I think it would have been helpful and really illuminating to all the members of the task force to have had this kind of a discussion. And also, I appreciate the committee's time, given the time that we have left in session and knowing what we schedule is and the fact that this is a bill that has a zero fiscal on. I really appreciate the time and effort that you are taking to clearly understand the bill. One of the things that I want to address is cost containment. Cost containment is like global budgeting. They're really sexy words. And when you throw those words around, there's kind of an aura that you really know a lot about what you're talking about, and you leave people with an impression. And the sad part of it is that if there's someone who can use that term easily, you understand a very complex thing, which cost shifting is, which global budgeting is. Cost shifting is very complicated. I wish I had Senator Benton's clarity with knowing exactly how it works, because in all the discussions that we had on the task force and a lot of the information that I've read, nobody really knows about cost shifting. They know some of the things that
that cause it. They know some of the things that make it better. They know some of the things that make it worse, but nobody knows exactly how much better or how much worse. It's just something that's out there that we deal with. Same thing with global budget. It's a very complex issue, and it's very difficult to understand in just one shot. I think with the purpose of Senate Bill 242, I won't at all disagree that the bill will have an element of cost shifting. But in fact, all the bills that have been introduced in the Senate this year, Senate Bill 83, Senate Bill 74, which we passed today, Senate Bill 242, and Senate Bill 290, all have an element of cost shifting. And the reason for that is that unless you have a universal system and you have a one-payer system, you're going to have some kind of cost shifting. There's just no way to get around it. For example, Senate Bill 83, this is a mechanism that put together a health authority that basically, as I recall, pooled all of the state employees.
No, that's incorrect.
And,
that's
okay. But really put some aggressive cost containment measures in. And there was cost shifting in that. And that the public benefited from the cost shifting, and of course the providers did. The Senate Bill 74, as we discussed this morning, there is some cost shifting. It's hard to know exactly who's going to be experiencing it, and it's hard to know exactly how much. Same thing with Senate Bill 242, the same thing with Senate Bill 290. No question about it, any one of these mechanisms that we have do have an element of cost shifting. With respect to Senate Bill 242, there's two things that you need to remember, a couple of things you need to remember about that. Number one is that the insurance commissioner has to approve the plan. If he doesn't like it, if the actuaries that work for the state don't think it's appropriate, it's not going to go anywhere. It's going to be sent back to the authority, and they're going to have to redo it at their expense. The management of the program and the expense of the program is really going to lie with the insurance company. It's not going to lie with the state. It's a permissive program in that it makes insurance available for a group of people who apparently can't get it now. It's hard to predict exactly what the premium is going to be because we don't know, A, what that premium is going to look like, and B, how many people are going to be buying it. So there are some questions about the expense of the premium, but I don't think anybody, and not even Senator Duncan and all his wisdom, can say exactly what that premium is going to be. Nobody can say that it's going to be 135%, 110%. It might even be less. But we're not going to know that until the program is in place. And we have, again, a mechanism. We have a review of the Division of Insurance. And we also have, and I don't object at all, to the sunset clause that the Division has recommended. I think that's a good idea. If it isn't working, then we can cut it out. But in the meantime, it gives us an opportunity to do some insurance reform, to provide some access to some people. And if you do increase access, whether it's 16,000 or 10,000 people, and you remove them from the uninsured, and you remove them from the uncompensated care load, you're probably going to have a little bit of an impact in cost reduction. But nobody knows how much that's going to be.
So I just need to interrupt. I've got to go.
That's fine.
And I just wondering, do you want me to
we're
back in about a half hour? I mean,
we're adjourned in a minute here. But okay. There's another Finance Committee meeting, my understanding, Senator Petula is preparing some adjustments or changes to the operating budget, and the schedule was to come back at 4:30 for that meeting of the Finance Committee.
Okay.
Okay, just let me finish. Senate Bill 242, in some generalities, is very similar to Senate Bill 74, which we passed today, has a lot of the same problems, a lot of the same concerns, and at least at the present time, we have a zero fiscal note, and it may be that there is going to be some fiscal cost, and I'm looking forward to seeing that, and I thank Senator Duncan for requesting that information from the department. But Senate Bill 242 and Senate Bill 74 have a tendency to complement each other, and I think that these two pieces of legislation are each by themselves a small step forward. Together they might have an impact that's a little bit greater, and maybe it's two steps forward. But I think, you know, given the current fiscal condition of our state, given, you know, many other concerns, I think it's appropriate to take small steps. And I think that's where Senator Duncan and I digress, and I think that eventually we will get to a universal healthcare system. I hope that someday we're able to, and I hope I'm here to be able to put that together, but I think that by implementing some of these mechanisms, through the things that they do right, as well as through the things that they do wrong, we'll have information to be able to put together a plan that really will provide coverage for all Alaskans, and I think we'll be better for having at least done these things to at least what will allow us to get some information.
Senator Collins, thank you very much. And Mr. Evans, you had signed up previously. I know there was another representative of your association testified. Did you? Oh, was there anybody else desiring to testify on 242? If not, we'll conclude the hearing, and hopefully we'll have all the pieces back, and we'll just get to those specific pieces on Monday. My apologies for all the things that we didn't do. We will move forward on Monday. Thank you very much.
You've had a long day. There are, in your packet, amendments to the budget. The budget is unchanged from the one that we've been in caucus for quite some time on. But there are amendments before you from the Office of the Governor. They're the front page amendments. There's one small one from the University of Alaska. There is one from DNR, and that is a suggestion that I have. And I would have recommended it previously, but it slipped through. There's one from the Department of Law. They would like much more, but I've reduced it to 25 for suggestion. There is one from Senator Zaroff's request for Department of Commerce and Economic Development. And those are the only ones that I have or I've been contacted on. And I would, we are to order. And yes, Senator Schultz.
Yes, I was going to ask a quick question. Citizens Advisory Council, were you going to?
And the Citizens Advisory Council was mentioned to me. I seem to have a blank on that, but we know what it is. You're welcome to make that motion too. I think they're suggesting it be down to 100, and that's just, I'm glad you mentioned. You have four.
Well, we have one amendment as well. If you read it.
Yes. You have four.
I was just going to say I have essentially a typo error in DOT. If I could at some point address that.
You might wish to right now, and I'd be perfectly happy to have you do that.
We had adopted
sort of way for Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, we had adopted intent language back when we last considered the budget on DOT under the Anchorage International Airport, and with talking about the marketing effort, the language was for the Anchorage International Airport to continue to involve, and then we had said the Alaska Economic Development Corporation and private industries. That should have been Anchorage Economic Development Corporation instead of Alaska. It's just the name of the group was different. I don't know if it takes a motion or we can just direct somebody to make that correct change for the title.
Well, I would move and ask unanimous consent that it be adopted. There's no problem with that. Unless you think some other action is necessary. There seems to be no problem. Does Senator Adams have a complete...
Yes, I do.
Mr. Chairman...
you have floor.
During our deliberations with Commerce and Economic Development, we determined that we had a problem with the Alaska Public Lands Information Center for $40,000. I have a letter here from the regional director, Mr. Moorhead, and it's a $40,000 problem, and I'd like to see if you can see that in as well.
In order, you're welcome to make the motions. Before you, at this time, we have this packet prepared. Office of the Governor, are there objections to adoption of these budget changes? Add 470 in general funds to cover all components for COLA. Add 200,000 to contingency fund, which brings it to 4. And add 50,000. It had been reduced by 75 for lieutenant governors and for one position transfer. Are there objections to that?
Yes.
You have the floor.
What is the position of the caucus regarding COLA?
The understanding that we had with COLA was that when we take this bill down there, we may well have an amendment. There was no caucus direction on COLA at this time. It may well There may be a caucus direction in COLA. Is that not correct? That is correct. Are there further objections? Not for adoption. There's backup from the University of Alaska. That's a program they've had for several years. They requested maybe $75,000, two components. I think it's worthwhile keeping alive. I put it in for $25,000. I don't know if we'll survive the tender mercies of Mr. Stastny's boss or not, or Mr. Stastny and his little man. But anyway, I think it's very justified. And it is in... Very much. There's no objection. It's adopted. Department of Natural Resources, that is the one thing that I proposed. I didn't do it during the budget process until now. It is an add-on, but it's been done every year, an intern program that supported budding archaeologists, and they've done a lot of work out there in DNR. They also receive a lot of valuable training, and it ties in the university program in geological management. It used to be DDGS. And I would ask your indulgence and adoption of that particular component. There's no objections, adoption. Department of Law, the former Assistant Attorney General and the present Assistant Attorney General say that conference and Western Conference of Attorney Generals, they need about 60,000. I suggested that the state and would put up 25. Senator Dan Inouye, the Solicitor of the Interior, and many others will be attending the meeting in Fairbanks. It seemed like it was a reasonable request. Department of Law did, through contract and a very close look at its budget, have some reductions. And this is a very modest request, $25,000.
We're not used through fees.
I guess they pick up money through contributions for the balance.
I was suggesting we increase the registration fee.
Right.
But I would think it's
important. Sure. Objections. Department of Commerce and Economic Development. Senator Zaroff is strongly endorsing this during caucus and after caucus, and I just bring it before you. We reduced the original request by $120,000, leaves $150,000 just to fund small business development assistance in Alaska Business Development Center. I don't know if Senator Zaroff's here. You have the floor.
Mr. Chairman, I did go back and do a little research on this, and it had been our hope that there's another statewide group that does get a grant. It's been a hope at one point that we could consolidate all the activities under what's called the Small Business Development Center, not to be confused with this, and that they would pick up some of the activities that have been done formerly under what was called the Small Business Counseling Center. That work is not being done to assist fishermen apply for and work out problems with the commercial fishing zone and other kinds of problems. This money, we have checked with the department and we've checked with other people. It seems like it would be probably a good use of money in addressing an area that had been addressed up until this last year in the budget. And it's not going to be done or picked up by any other way of funding.
Is there objection to this? With no objections adopted. Senator Schultz, you had a request.
DEC budget.
What do you got on your
letter of intent. Do you think there's something more? There are two letters of intent there, or two intent. The first intent speaks only to the DRUs in the areas in which it, affected by sanitation, wastewater disposal, and drinking water DRUs. There's an area where they were planning on implementing some new fees, and we're just saying
Please proceed.
Yeah, and we're just asking is that the intent of the legislature, the department not implementing any of these proposed fees. And then the intent number two, which speaks in the, to the generalities of all of their fees, it just says any fee increases considered by the department should be reasonable and efforts should be made to develop inexpensive, effective solutions to environmental quality issues without unnecessary cost to the public. And I guess it's fairly
Senator. This, Senator Schultz and I have discussed this, what's that word, ad nauseum or something like that. But I, the second intent, I think, is, you know, that should be true with all fees, and I sure don't have any objection to that. In fact, you know, those fees ought to reflect actual costs and, you know, go be held accountable that they are reasonable, not just something to harass people or drive them out of business or to collect extra fees to run other kinds of things in the division that is not called for. The first intent, though, I still object to, and the problem is, you can read the language last year in the intent section a couple of ways, but if we were fairly clear at least that encouraging DEC to go out and charge fees for things that they hadn't charged fees for, and typically things like restaurant inspection. But in addition, there were some other things. In this year's budget, in sanitation, wastewater disposal, and drinking water VRUs, the governor submitted a budget that took out $377,000 for sanitation, took out $27,000 for lab support, took out $71,000 for drinking water, and $136,000 for wastewater and treatment in general funds, and replaced those with program receipts, specifically to do the same business that they had been doing, but charging fees for them. So, with this intent language, I don't know quite what we're saying. If we don't want them to charge fees, we still want them to do wastewater inspections and drinking water inspections and food inspections, we need to add back general funds to those components.
Mr. Chairman, I disagree with that. These people are going to